time, we saw that the Rav's Hesped, Rav Chaim Moshe Grushinsky, was certainly one of the most basic and clear-cut Aguda statements made in the United States. The Rav's description of Rav Chaim Moshe and his beautiful eulogy of the breastplate and the headplate that sits in the Choshen and not to separate between them certainly represents the concept of Da'at Torah or Das Torah, and the idea that in all areas, way beyond the narrow halachic, but political and social areas, rabbis have to make decisions and they have to be followed by the masses that look up to them. Then, of course, came the war, and I mentioned one incident during the war that I will come back to later today, the 1943 march on the White House, where Roosevelt refuses to accept the Rabbanim. It's 2 days before Yom Kippur, 3 days before Yom Kippur, 2 days. Wednesday was the march. Friday was Erev Yom Kippur, with all that that implies, and a few hundred Rabbanim, members of the Agudat HaRabbanim, members of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, march in Washington, and the best they can do is have an inconsequential meeting with the Vice President Wallace. Following World War II, Mori Rebbe, my Rebbe, the Rav Rav Soloveitchik, is identified with the Mizrahi movement. Much ink has already been spilled, and many lectures have been given. What made the Rav change his mind? However, we don't have to ask too many questions here because the Rav himself asked the question and the Rav himself explains it. And the heart of last week's lecture was, of course, how the Rav interprets the controversy between Joseph and his brothers, the dreams, the question of preparing for tomorrow. The brothers were content to remain in Eretz Canaan. They were not concerned with the fact they would have to be strangers in a land that is not theirs, deal with a new technology, a new reality, a new civilization. Yosef, on the other hand, said we must think ahead and must prepare. And the Rav said this was the same machloket between Mizrahi and Aguda. He calls the Mizrahi the Yosef of 1902 because 100 years ago the Mizrahi was organized in Vilna. And he says this was exactly the machloket. Mizrahi felt we cannot be content with what we have in Europe. We have to look for tomorrow. We have to prepare. And the Aguda felt we have Brisk, we have Slabodka, we have Mir, we have the great Hasidic centers, we have Frankfurt, we have Berlin. B'kivshei d'rachmana lamali. We don't have to be involved with God's secrets. We have to do what we can now, and what will happen tomorrow is God's concern. And here the Rav develops a theological stance which has very far-reaching implications, that when it comes to a machloket in halacha, the majority always wins. And he quoted the Gemara of Bava Metzia, Daf Nun Tet, Tanu D'Achnai, the famous sugya, and there the heavenly voice rings out, the halacha is like Rebbe Eliezer, it does not help. The majority decided, we do not look back. More important, we do not look up. When it comes to Hashkafa, the Rav explains, we learned from Yosef Yechov, there's no concept of majority, no concept of minority. Yosef was in a distinct minority, 11 to 1 against him. And nevertheless, Yosef was absolutely right. We have to look what God wants, where God is leading us. We have to constantly revise our thinking. We cannot issue a political, economic, sociological dogma and say this is like a psak halacha. Once a psak halacha is given, that is it. Here, according to the Rav, we constantly have to shift gears, look up, be concerned, interpret what's happening, see whether our previous path is successful or whether we have to undertake a new point of view. And the Rav said the Hashkacha has rung out quite clearly. The halacha is like Yosef HaTzadik, like the Mizrahi. And following World War II, we see the greatness of the Mizrahi ideology. They wanted to leave Europe. They wanted to go on Aliyah. They wanted to prepare for tomorrow. They wanted to prepare a refuge for Torah. And the Rav explains that's why he became a Mizrahiite. What's fascinating is, and we ended off the last Shayur, that of all the Rav has said and published, and remember, by the 1970s into the 80s, there were thousands of pages published with the Rav's authorization. And nevertheless, the only aspect of the Rav's published writings that Rav Shach saw fit to criticize, to attack, was Yosef Yechav. And I showed you the source in the collected letters, writings of Rav Shach in volume 4, his very highly critical stance against the Rav's concept of Mizrahi Anagota. And there's no question that on this issue, Rav Shach is absolutely right in criticizing the Rav from his point of view, because here, if the Rav is right, Rav Shach is wrong. If Rav Shach is right, then the Rav is wrong. And here you have the head-on clash between Aguda and Mizrahi ideology. And we ended off the shiur last week by quoting from Rav Shach, where he criticizes Bnei Akiva, how the Rav praises Mizrahi and Torah, and Rav Shach views it, no, that there's a breakdown of the old traditional yeshiva, and take a look at Bnei Akiva. And on the other hand, we saw that the Rav, when he wins the prize of Zalman Shazar for Chinuch in the Gola in the 1970s, the substantial amount of money that was awarded to him, he immediately tells his children, sign my name and give the check to Merkaz Yeshiva Bnei Akiva in Tel Aviv. So you see that the machloket continues, and this is a head-on collision of two great ideologies. Now, this is one reason, and here I come into an area that has never been put together as I'm going to put it together now. Rabbi Lichtenstein started me thinking on this line with his article in the last issue of Alon Shvut, and I've now come with many sources to buttress Rabbi's thinking and to explain the Rav. Perhaps there's another reason why the Rav became a Mizrahiite. When you study the Rav's writings and you listen to the Rav's drashot, you see that basic to the Rav's thinking is activism. It all begins in the Rav's magnum opus in Ish Halacha, where you see how the Rav, when he describes Ish Halacha, describes his family, describes Reb Chaim. Time and again, the Rav stresses their innovative, creative minds. And the Rav portrays the concept of creating, that this is imitating God, imitatio Deo. In other words, basic to our thinking, how do we know what is moral, what is ethical? Basic to our thinking in Chazal, we imitate God. Mahu rachum, mafata rachum, mahu chanun, mafata chanun, mahu gamel chasadim, mafata tikmol chasadim. Whatever God does, whatever we can learn from God, how he clothes Adam and Eve, how he attends their wedding, how he buries people, whatever we can see in the Torah, we have to emulate. This teaches us to be gracious, to be merciful. And the Rev goes further. God created the world. God is a creator. Man has to create. When man creates, he creates in God's image. And the Rav feels that Reb Chaim, that the whole tradition of Torah Shebaal Peh, that we create concepts, we create understanding, we create analysis, we create dialogue in the rabbinic tradition. Reb Chaim, his grandfather, his revolutionary approach, the vocabulary he developed towards explaining the Gemara, towards explaining the Rambam, what we call Reb Chaim's Derech, the Lashon Yeshiva, all this was intellectual creation. And intellectual creation by the human being is a reflection of the greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of the greatness of God. This is man utilizing his great abilities, imitatio Deo, emulating God Almighty. Man has to be an activist. Man has to be a creator. Now, this concept begins in Ish Halacha. When you go into the Rav's second most famous philosophic essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, where he deals with Adam 1 and Adam 2, and he deals with the creation of the world. In that very essay, you see that man is the creator, man going out, man improving upon the world which he is given. It goes way beyond intellectual creation, but simply in a tangible fashion, in a material fashion, in a worldly fashion, man has to be a creator. This is part of the divine charge. And now, No one ever said it better than the Rav in a magnificent drasha he gave once again at a Mizrahi convention in the 50s, when Mizrahi was still, as I've explained, a viable, dynamic, powerful organization on the American scene. It has not yet been overtaken by Agudat Yisrael. By the 60s already, Aguda starts to overtake Mizrahi. But in the 50s, the Mizrahi convention, the Rav's talks, these were red-letter days for Torah Jewry. And here, you find this in Chamesh Drashot, beginning on page 113, but here the Rav explains from another point of view why he became a Mizrahiite. And here you see the activism come to the fore. And it's right with the parshiyot that we have just read, that we have struggled with. Perhaps there's no more difficult chapter in Sefer Bereshit than the whole question of the brachot, how Rivka engages in a chicanerous act and encourages Yaakov to get the brachot that his father Yitzchak wanted to give to Esav. And we see in the Torah, we see in Bereshit, we see here in Pasha Toldot that something is happening. There's a controversy. There's a duality of ideas between Yitzchak and Rivka. One favors Yaakov, one favors Esav. What is happening here? And the Rav turns their machloket into the machloket of Agudat Yisrael and Mizrahi. What was the viewpoint of Yitzchak Avinu? Yitzchak Avinu, practically Akedat Yitzchak, practically Aseh Oleh Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, practically sacrificed before God. Yitzchak Avinu, filled with holiness, with sacredness, with sanctity, he saw his son Yaakov, the man of the tent, the man of the tent of Torah, V'Yaakov Yoshev Ohalim, the man who inhabited the tent of Torah. He saw Yaakov and he felt this was the greatest achievement. Yaakov needed no more than to study Torah, than to be great in Torah, than to be knowledgeable. When Yaakov will need worldly matters, he'll turn to his brother Esav. His brother Esav will be the individual, Yodei Tzayed, Ish Sadeh. He'll be the man of the field. He'll be the man who can provide the industry. He'll be the individual who will provide the food, who will provide the clothes, who will build the shelter. Yaakov has only one goal in life, to remain in the tent of Torah. Esav, he will be the one involved in the public thoroughfare, in the Reshut HaRabim. Yaakov's responsibility will be the Reshut HaYachid, to study Torah, to learn Torah, to create Torah, to be Mechadesh in Torah, but he need not wander beyond his tent. All his needs will be supplied by Esav and his descendants. Yaakov has no need, I'm quoting the Rav, Lihinazem and Asadah, he has to keep away from the Tohu Avohu Shel Chayli Chaye Chulan, for he has to keep away from mundane life, from the hurly-burly of life, from the maelstroms of life, from the vicissitudes of life, from the political, economic, material realities that constantly involve heartache and compromise and success and frustration, and you're thwarted and you have to deal with so many individuals. No, Yaakov doesn't need this. Yaakov has to remain pure and holy. Esav will take care of these matters for him. That was Yitzchak's viewpoint. Rivka, on the other hand, tells her son Yaakov, Lechnal Hatzon, my dear son, and I'm quoting the Rav, learn how to go out into the field, learn how to fight, learn how to be involved in economic development and material prosperity. Chas v'chalila, that the Torah Jew, the Jewish people, the people of learning and Torah Shebech Tav and Torah Shebech Keh, that beyond Torah, we will not be educated with worldly knowledge, with temporal ability, that we will not be able to go out and care for ourselves and prepare for ourselves. Chas v'chalila, Rivka felt that if we're totally dependent upon the non-Jew, upon Esav, then the Torah student cannot survive. Rivka felt intrinsically that for the tent of Jacob, the tent of Torah, to thrive, to strive, we have to be able to have a material and temporal successful base as well. One influences the other. One complements the other. One supplements the other. And chas v'chalila, we should leave our temporal well-being in the hands of others, in the hands of Esav, who at times will be our friends, but at other times will be our most determined and most complete enemies. And she tells her son, leave the tent of Torah, go out, bring the sheep, learn how to slaughter, learn how to prepare, get the blessing from your father, Mital HaShemayim and Mishmanei Aretz. You need not only the tent, but the blessings of heaven and the blessings of earth. And the Rav says, here too, the Hashgacha Pratit rang out loud and clear that the halacha is like Rivka. Take a look at the Pasha. Who wins out? Who finally admits he was wrong? Who finally gives the blessing with all his heart and soul? I blessed him, and he will be blessed. Yaakov gains it now from Yitzchak. Yitzchak admits Rivka absolutely right. And in modern day terminology, the Rav once again puts it into the context of the controversy between Agudah and Mizrahi. What did Agudah achieve in Israel? Agudah does not leave the ghetto. Agudah builds yeshiva Hasidic courts. But where are they in the mainstream of life? Where are they with the Tal HaShemayim Mashmani Aretz? Where are they in the temporal matters? Take a look what Mizrahi has done. They have built kibbutzim. They have been involved with all the workers, Papua Mizrahi, with social justice. They have been involved in setting up Mamlachti Dati schools for the masses of Jewish children in the state of Israel. Look how Mizrahi's vision goes way beyond the tent of Torah. Mizrahi is like Rivka, and the Hashgacha won out. The Hashgacha declared, Rivka is right. And here the Rav uses words, and these words epitomize this drasha. It perhaps today, when we look back after, thank God, so many decades of the state of Israel, we look at it and we consider it quixotic. But isn't this the heart of the achievement? And the Rav describes Rivka telling Yaakov, Shom biyadacha tangzik et hagemara, ubishinya et hamachshera, lichbosh et hadama, v'yatacher ev lehitgonen. With one hand, you'll hold the Gemara. And with the other hand, you'll hold a plowshare to conquer the land and a sword to protect yourself. And isn't this a magnificent description of what Mizrahi, Hapoel Mizrahi, Bnei Akiva, the kibbutzim datayim, in our time, when the Rav said this drasha did not yet exist, the yeshivat hezda, the ulpanat and the michlalot for the girls, and all that Mizrahi, the yeshiva k'tam tzvayot, before you go into the army to prepare you to take a year or two off for intensive learning and then to become officers in the army. Isn't this an exact description of the Mizrahi, of Rivka and Hamachloket with Yitzchak Avinu, and the Hashgacha rings out, Rivka is right, chas v'chalila, that Yaakov should be dependent upon Esav, that the Torah Jew should not be able to hold the Gemara in one hand and a plowshare and a sword in the other hand. So you see, Here too, in this drasha, you see the activism. You see the Rav as an activist. And you see the Rav continuing the theme of Ish Halacha, continuing the theme of the lonely man of faith, of Ish HaEmunah, as it's known in Hebrew. You see the Rav describing Mizrahi in terms of activism, vis-a-vis Agudat Yisrael, where its creativeness, its creative ability, its being a Yotzer, it being a Borei Olamot like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is only limited to the tenth of Torah. In another drasha that the Rav gave, he develops exactly the same idea. This was another drasha to the Mizrahi, and I'm quoting beginning on page 40 in the Chamesh Drashot, and the Rav first begins with the whole concept of Rebbe and Talmud relationship. He goes back to Avraham Avinu. What are we told about Avraham Avinu? Hanefesh asher asa b'Charan. That Avraham Avinu created people in Haran. Created people. Avraham Avinu created people. Ribbono shel Olam, we all know we might have a midwife, we might have an obstetrician, we might have a doctor, a woman gives birth. But no one would say that the doctor, the midwife, the obstetrician created this child. What does it mean, created people? And Chazal tell us, Avraham megayet anashim, v'sara megayeret et anashim. That Avraham influenced the men, Sarah influenced the women to take upon themselves monotheism, to take upon themselves proper belief, to stop worshiping idols. So what do you see here? Avraham is a creator. Sarah is a creator in a spiritual sense. And when you create in a spiritual sense, it's as if you've given life to these people. Hanefesh aser asa b'charan. The Rav explains, this is why a Talmud has to be subservient to his Rebbe. Because his Rebbe created him. His Rebbe gave him wisdom. His Rebbe gave him a Weltanschauung. His Rebbe gave him a world view. And with that concept in mind, just as a person creates a factory, the factory is his, the bank is his, a person has a patent, the Rebbe has a patent on his Talmud. He creates him. But here, the Rebbe once again goes one step further. Creation, being a Yotzer, not only in a spiritual sense, in a physical sense as well. And here the Rav comes back to Divrei Torah. This goes back to Rav Chaim, and the Rav so many times dealt with it. We all know that when we talk about Eretz Yisrael has Kedusha, is holy. Where did it get this Kedusha? We came to Eretz Yisrael two times. Bia Rishona and Bia Shnia. Bia Rishona, the first time we came was Bizman Yehoshua. The second time we came was Bizman Ezra. Now, where is the sanctity of the land? And we posek la halacha, the Rambam, Bia Rishona kidshah l'shaita v'lo kidshah l'atid lavo. The first sanctity was only limited, it was circumscribed. When we left the land at the end of the first commonwealth, that sanctity disappeared. That sanctity was abrogated, negated. When we talk about Bia Shnia Kidsha La Shaita, the Kidsha La Atid Lavo. It was a permanent, ongoing, everlasting, eternal sanctity. It did not end when the Second Commonwealth ended, and whatever sanctity the land has today goes back to the Bia Shnia, to those who came at the time of Ezra. And of course, the question is why? What was the difference between the coming at the time of Yeshua and the coming at the time of Ezra? And of course, we explain that at the time of Yehoshua, it was kibush. It was war. It was a battle. We conquered the land. At the time of Ezra, it was chazakah. We worked the land. We improved the land. We created a society, an economy. We created the second commonwealth with our blood, with our sweat, with our tears. And what is the difference? The first time we came, it was war. We were powerful. Yehoshua. We conquered it. Conquest only keeps the land holy as long as the conquest is in effect. As long as we are the rulers, then the conquest is viable and the sanctity remains. The second time we came, we worked the land. And if I can quote the Rav, when we came back from Babylonia, there was no army. We were a few. This is the Gemara, of course, at the start of Asara Yuchsin, at the end of Kedushin. We were poor. We were totally dependent upon Persia, upon Cyrus, upon a foreign power. And nevertheless, we went to work. We worked the land. Chashuat Atmata, Zarubato, Hishku Amayim, Akru et Simchei Hapera, Katzru et Tfuata, Vehikshimu Bechayehem et Koa Klalim Vahapratim Shel Torat Moshe, Umimela Nitkatsha Haaretz. We worked the land. We had to get rid of the weeds. We had to plow. We had to plant. We had to sow. We had to harvest. We had to build factories. We had to build an economy. We had to start from scratch. There were no miracles this time. This was not a conquest at a divine command. This was not kibush. This was chazakah. And chazakah, when you put your effort in, when you imitate the Odeo, when you emulate God, when you build, when you create, nothing can take this sanctity away. And Kedusha Shniya, Kidsha L'Shaita, the Kidsha L'Atid Lavo, and that sanctity lasts until today. And time and again, the Rav would come back to this theme, the Rav would repeat the difference between Kibush and Chazakah, and the Rav would constantly claim that Mizrahi, the Mizrahi point of view, is chazakah. It's getting involved in the mainstream of life, the maelstrom of life, not retreating to a ghetto, not escaping from the difficulties, but right out there in every aspect of life, creating university and scholarship and industry and farming and agriculture and army and air force and navy, and going out way beyond the ghetto, and with chazakah, sanctifying the land, sanctifying the people, and sanctifying the experience of the Jew who has returned home, al admat hakodesh, in contradistinction to the aguda point of view of ghettoization. And the Rev repeated this theme many times in years to come. And of course, if this is correct, this activism, and Rabbi Lichtenstein begins this thing, but I've added much more to it, this activism, which became so intrinsic to the Rav's thinking, now we can understand why he changed his mind and why that march on Washington becomes a black letter day in the Rav's experiences in the United States. Agudat Yisrael, Agudat HaRabbanim, their attitude was one of passiveness. Their attitude was one of shtatlanut, of going back to dealing with Gentile governments when the Jew had no power, when there was no democracy, where we had to plead, cajole, and bribe, like Yaakov Avinu, Vayishklach Lefanav, sending Esav all the gifts to appease him. And you all know that that was a valid approach throughout the ages, as the Chafetz Chaim said, whenever Yaakov has to meet Esav, we have to emulate the biblical Yaakov, the biblical Jacob, and treat the Gentile accordingly. And of course, With this in mind, the Jews didn't demonstrate. I go to Israel, the Jews didn't boycott. Everyone called for a boycott of Hitler. The Jews didn't boycott. The Jews were not activists. The Jews did not yell. The Jews did not shout. And finally, in 1943, when every minute that we walked the face of the earth at that time, tens of thousands of Jews are being killed every hour on the other side of the ocean, and the finest and the most wonderful rabbis on the American scene go to Washington, the president refuses to see them. You suddenly cannot become an activist overnight and expect to have results. It has to be an ongoing, long-standing vision program, understanding concretely outlined. You can't one day walk to Washington if everything is not prepared in advance, if the ground is not sowed in advance, if the ground is not harvested, if the seeds are not planted. And evidently, that was the finality. When the Rav saw how Wallace treated them, sent them away, Roosevelt refused to see them. I referred you to the Boston Rebbetzin's memoirs. People became tremendous activists afterwards. The Rav was among them. The Boston Rebbe, of course, is another prime example. And Rebbe constantly referred back to that tragedy in 43 and his whole attitude at that period in time until he shifted. And Rebbe said, and I quote from the Rav, 1806, the Rav stated this. I was back at this convention. I was sent by the Israeli government to address the Rabbinical Council of America convention. It was on June 20th, 1977. And the Rav delivered a brilliant paper on a sugya in Sanhedrin dealing with Agada, Daf Vav Amud Bet, Daf Zayin Amud Aleph. And in the middle of the talk, the Rav got involved with our inactivity in World War II. And he said, and he repeated this many times, I heard it from him, but I'm quoting from the Rav word by word now. The Rav said, we have to add another Al Chet to our prayers on Yom Kippur. Al Chet sheshemanu et kol tzakat achenu b'yayrapa, v'lo asinu dai, v'lo asinu maspek. For the sins we have committed in being unresponsive to the cries of our brethren in Europe, who were being brutally slaughtered. And the Rav said, he's talking about Mordechai. He was quite right. I'm not blaming anybody. I'm blaming myself. Why didn't I act like Mordechai when he heard the news about the evil decree issued by Mechamen Achashverosh? Why didn't I emulate Mordechai Ve'etzei B'tochai V'yizak Zakah G'dolah U'marah? Why didn't I go out into the center of the city and shout bitterly and loudly? Why didn't I shout, yell, cry? Why didn't I tear my clothes like Mordechai? Why didn't I awaken the Jewish leaders? And here's the Rav, Bifnei Am V'Eda, in front of thousands upon thousands of rabbis and their families, clapping Al Chet. And in that Al Chet, you hear the reflection of the shifting of theologies, of the shifting of gears. You hear the reflection of the slamming of the door by the President of the United States in 1943. You hear the Rebbe's regret. Why didn't we demonstrate? Why didn't we yell? Why didn't we shout? We live in a democracy. Why didn't we plead? Why didn't we cajole? Why did we allow the Nazis to do what they did? And when we finally started to yell and shout, it was too late. We could not change the course of World War II. And I have to tell you something that I'm an eyewitness to that happened. It has to be the late 50s. Rebbe had just finished shiur. And as I've mentioned so many times, he didn't walk out of the room right away. Generally, he fell back in his chair. I think you've heard descriptions of this. He was tired. He had just said shiur. There was no clock in the room. It wasn't a basketball game. It wasn't a football game. It was a baseball game. In a baseball game, there's no clock. And when the Rebbe gave shiur, there was no clock that was running. So in his prime, he could say shiur 2.5 hours, 2 3/4 hours, and You finished the shiur, you fell backward. But students have no mercy. The better students, or the more committed students, I don't know what word to use, we would bother Rebbe after shiur. And I'll never forget. And he was off the cuff, very honest with us. This was not a public moment where he had to weigh his P's and Q's and be circumspect in what he was saying. He was very, very off the cuff and very honest. And Meir Kahana, Rabbi Meir Kahana, Hashem Yikom Damo, was just beginning at that time. It's when the first public waves were being made about the Jews in Russia. And you have to understand, we were very frightened of the communists. It was right after Sputnik. If I'm not mistaken, Sputnik was 1957, and the Russians had sent this spaceship into space, into orbit, and America was in a state of panic. We did not know how corrupt, what a Potemkin's village the communist empire was from within. We had no idea. This we only find out 20, 30 years later. But at that time, there was tremendous fear. And the Jews now had been without teachers, without yeshiva in Russia from 1917 to 1957, 1958. Who could believe there were Jews left? And yet there was a slight reawakening. And Meir was going out already and organizing. There were some demonstrations. And the students turned to Rebbe right after class. One of the students said, we were talking, and we said to Rebbe, Rebbe, should we demonstrate, you know, the Russian Jews? And the Rebbe looked at us, what? We should make the same mistake we made, that we didn't demonstrate against Hitler? And he came full cycle. Now, years later, I'm told that the Rebbe responded, and here too he totally came full cycle. When he was asked years later about demonstrating about Russian Jewry, I heard him in the late 50s with my own ears, right after class, where Rebbe said, and with emotion, what, we should make the same mistake we made in the late 30s? Absolutely, we have to demonstrate, yell and shout, and not imitate and not emulate what we did vis-a-vis Hitler. Years later, the Rebbe was asked the same question, and again he answered, to demonstrate, but he said, you have to consult the political experts. And you see, it totally left the realm of Das Torah. Whether to demonstrate or not demonstrate was not a question that the rabbis could decide. Years later already, the Lubavitcher Rebbe was saying not to demonstrate. The Lubavitcher Rebbe had, as you all know, connections in Russia that never ended, that never ceased. Throughout the communist empire, Chabad Hasidus continued to function in Russia, and the Rebbe had connections, and the Rebbe felt that the demonstrations were counterproductive. Rabbi Teitz from Elizabeth, New Jersey, who was also active, working with the authorities, working within the regime, working within the system, also felt, leave it to Shtat Lanut, we shouldn't demonstrate. When Rebbe was asked, he said, we have to weigh and we have to consult with the political experts, the people who are university people, political scientists, the people who know what's going on in Russia, and then we have to reach a conclusion. But what was fascinating, once again, it was not Das Torah. The whole approach, it's not that the Lubavitcher Rebbe is right or that Rav Pinchas Mordechai Teitz is right, and I personally can give and have a lot to say on this issue because I lived it, I was part of it, I understood it, and there were moments where the Rebbe was right and there were moments where he was totally wrong. And there were moments where Rav Teitz was acting the way he should have within that context, but it was tragic when he tried to continue the same type of operation when the entire situation on the ground had changed. But once again, Rebbe's approach was that of an activist. That of an activist, but you have to have the political and, I would say, scientific expert opinion so that you can reach a proper conclusion. And while I won't go into it today, I only want to allude to it to keep the context flowing, you want to see how Rebbe totally changed his outlook, his hashkafer, his Weltanschein, how much he has moved beyond the tzitz and the choshen mishpat, the head plate and the breastplate of his drasha, of his eulogy for Reb Chaim Moshe Grishinsky. You have, of course, a burning issue, which we will come to in one of our future lectures, where you ask the question of land for peace, of compromising and giving back part of the sacred holy land of the state of Israel, the land that has the Kedusha of Biyashnia, Kedusha Shnia, Kitshali Shaitavi, Kitshali Atid Lavo, as we explained a few minutes ago, and you're talking about giving back the land for peace. And what was Rebbe's point of view? This is not a rabbinic decision. This is not a halachic decision. It has little to do with rabbinic output, but it has to do with the input of the political military experts who can understand the situation on the ground. And in accordance with their understanding, then we have to act. And the Rabbanim, Einam Ma'alim, the Einam Moridim, their viewpoint, their commitment, their understanding has little to do with the answer that has to be given. The rabbis have to listen to the military political experts. And that's exactly the way Rebbe later approached the question, the quandary of demonstrating against Russia, of yelling and shouting, going out to the streets. And this was a very real question in the 60s, into the 70s, not so much into the early 80s, because by then it was obvious what course of action had to be taken. But in the 60s, into the 70s, this was a real quagmire. What do you do? Demonstrate, chas v'chalila, you can harm the Jews in Russia. They'll be persecuted all the more by the powerful Russian communist atheist empire. Or no, by demonstrating the great, mighty Russian empire, which in reality is very impoverished, very poor, totally dependent to a certain degree upon foreign currency, which means help from the Western countries. If you demonstrate and yell and shout and get the American and the English and the Canadian and the Australian and the politicians from Belgium and other countries to make their aid and help and agreements with Russia conditional upon easing restrictions against Jews and battling anti-Semitism within Russia, it could be that we have to demonstrate. But this is something that rabbis cannot decide. You need the political experts, the scientific experts, the professors who deal with this material. They have to guide us. So you see the activism here. But when we asked Rebbe the question, off the cuff, after class, leaning back in his chair, the late 50s, Rabbi Meir Kahana first beginning, the formal organizations to help Soviet Jewry have not yet been organized, not the official ones and not the SSSJ, the student struggle for Soviet Jewry. It's long before, but his instinctive gut reaction was very informative, overwhelming, and very emotional. What? Make the same mistake we made in the late 30s when we didn't yell, shout, demonstrate, and boycott against Hitler? Chas v'chalila. And Rebbe's approach was absolutely positive. So if I can summarize this part of the shiur, you see there's a second reason. Yosef Yechav is a magnificent theological stanz where the Rav differentiates between halacha and hashkafa. Halacha, majority rules, and once they rule, we never look up, we never look sideways, we live according to the psak halacha. That is the Rambam in his Hakdama to Mishneh Torah, in his Hakdama to Seder Zrayim, to the Perish HaMishnayos LaRambam, and this is the exact approach to halacha. Hashkafa, we constantly have to revalue, we constantly have to look up, we constantly have to see how the reality meshes with the divine charge and the divine will. But more than that, that's not the only reason the Rebbe became a Mizrachiite. Innate to his personality, and it begins with his published writings, both on a spiritual level and later on a physical level, man should not sit back. Man has to create. Creation is imitatio Deo. Mahu bone alamot, afata bone alamot. Mahu yotze alamot, afata yotze alamot. You create. We create students. We create spirituality. We create disciples. We create novellas in Torah, chidushei Torah. We create psak halacha, but we create in a temporal, physical sense as well. And this was the machloket between Rivka and Yitzchak, a machloket l'shem shemayim. Does a Jew have to be ghettoized? Yaakov remains in the tent of Torah? Or does a Jew have to go out, in addition to Torah, hold the plowshare and hold the sword, in addition to holding the Gemara? And this was Rivka's viewpoint. This was Rivka's vision. Chas v'chalila, that we should be dependent upon Esav alone. And the Hashkacha Pratit rang out that Rivka is correct. And Rebbe became an activist. The 43 incident with Roosevelt, that incident was a catalyst, was a dark moment in his life. It probably was not the only incident that happened, but it's the one that remained embedded in his memory. And when he replays his life, he regrets the fact he didn't boycott, he didn't yell, he didn't shout, he didn't join forces against Hitler. And Rebbe becomes an activist. And this activism, he later explains in his drasha to the Mizrahi, and it reaches a crescendo where he compares the first coming at the time of Joshua to the second coming, the difference between conquest and constructive building. And it reflects in his Weltanschauung, and as I mentioned, demonstrating against Russia. And look how far Rebbe has moved, that it's not rabbinic advice we need, it is temporal experts who know what's happening in Russia, understand the political interplay, the military standoff, and they can give us advice how to act vis-a-vis the Russian Jew. My dear friends, we've come to the high point of all these lectures. And I may add, and I'm going to say Divrei Torah in the name of Rebbe now, this may be, arguably, I use the word arguably, because the Rebbe's life was so seminal and so filled with achievement, but this may be the high point of Rebbe's life. If I can quote from Rebbe, he gave a magnificent talk in his prime, when I was yet much younger than you and a student, sitting before the Rav, b'dechilu rechimu, with fear and trepidation, gave a yotzei drasha in memory of his father. One of these five and a half hour drasha, the halacha of the Agada. And in the Agada, this has been written up in Yomei Zikaron, that was published by Moshe Krona years ago by the Jewish Agency, Torah Culture Department, but it comes nowhere near having heard the drasha, having been in the audience, having heard the Rav soaring in his magnificent Yiddish. And the Rav gave a drasha, which we refer to today as Shlichat Hadam. And the basic gist, I just want to summarize very briefly, is that everyone in life is created to achieve a certain purpose. God gives us a Shlichat in life. The human being does not know what a Shlichat is. But quoting the Maimer in Pirkei Avot, Ein lecha Adam shein lo sha'a. There is no one that doesn't have an ultimate moment in life that in retrospect, when he gets to heaven, God is going to look at him and say, well, you achieved that moment I put you in the earth for, or you failed. But there's an ultimate moment that you're there, and you don't even realize it, that your whole life before and afterwards goes back to that one moment when you climbed the mountain and achieved something that was apocryphal. And on the 8th anniversary, there's no one, no human being. It's a beautiful thought. Some of us are born with more talent than others. We're brighter. You know, those of you in chinuch, all my life I've been in chinuch. And I always say, I never had a student I didn't love. People, my wife looks at me, you know, how can it be? I had students, tzaddikim, rishayim, students who were saintly, students who were vulgar. I had all types of students. But I always had the ability to see the good in every student. In other words, I understand very well certain students are giants of intellect. Certain students are giants of emotion. Certain students are just TV addicts and baseball fans. But a good Rebbe has to deal with every student. And I could always see the good. Everyone is a human being, and everyone has holiness, and everyone basically strives to achieve a modicum of holiness. And a good Rebbe has to see that spark in every student. So, Ein lecha adam shein lo sha. It's a magnificent thought. It's not just the Rav. The Rav is the Rav. Who can be like the Rav? Who could be an einikel of Reb Chaim? Who could be a son of Reb Moshe? Who could be a grandson of Reb Elia Prushan? Who can be a great-grandson of the Beit HaLevi? Who could be a great-great-grandson of Reb Heschel Leib and Tziva Valashin? The Rav is the Rav, but not just the Rav. Every human being, Ein lecha adam shein lo sha. Certain moment in life, and arguably, I want to state that moment happened when little Ani Rothkopf was in the audience with thousands of others at Yeshiva University, Yom Ha'atzmaut 1956. It was the 8th anniversary of the State of Israel. And I'll never forget, it was sponsored by the Mizrahi. And Mizrahi, as I said a few moments ago, was still a very viable organization. As a matter of fact, this is just on the borderline. If you understand the history of American Orthodoxy, this is the year that the 11 Rosh Yeshiva come out with a psak halacha against participating in a mixed board of rabbis or in a mixed congregational organization such as the United Synagogue Council, where you have Reform Conservative and Orthodox. And the fact that they came out with that psak shows that this type of orthodoxy, which to a certain degree is identified with Agudat Yisrael Adom being very popular now on a topic that's very difficult and very involved, because I frankly agree with those who are against the Synagogue Council. But on a popular level, this is where the Agudat Yisrael orthodoxy for the first time is starting to show strength. So you're literally on a very important date, 1956. Mizrahi is still Mizrahi, but Aguda is beginning to bark on the American scene. It has grown from a little puppy. It's a little bit more mature today in 1956. And yet, the Lampert Auditorium is filled. The Rav is introduced by Rabbi David Hollander, then the rabbi of Mount Eden Center in the Bronx. The Bronx, Mount Eden Center, the entire Yiddishkeit had shifted from the East Bronx where Rav Moshe Bick lived. Now Mount Eden, near the concourse, near the, not just the concourse, a Bronxite says, the Grand Concourse. Near the Grand Concourse, here was Mount Eden Center, here was Rabbi Hollander, and Rabbi Hollander introduces the Rav. He spoke too long, as I recall, it was too long an introduction. When you introduce the Rav, you say, gentlemen, here is the President of the United States. Here is the Rav, Moreno the Rabbeinu. What are you going to waste time introducing him? But I remember it was a long introduction. And then Rav Hollander wanted to do justice to the Rav. And then the Rav got up and he delivered a paper which was epic making. Of anything, the Rav, and we were in the audience, I was there, my wife-to-be was there, there's a picture of the audience, I can pick myself out, I can pick Malkar out, we were young kids, we were teenagers, all the B'nai Akiva kids were there. I don't know how much I understood B'shas Maisa at the time, but I understood enough to know that this was a moment in history. What the Rav said that night has affected well over a few million lives, and as time marches on, it will reflect endless millions. The way the Rav said it, the ingeniousness of what he said, and his whole life afterwards, to a certain degree, is shaped by that night, 1956, and to me, that was arguably the moment he climbed the highest hill, the highest apex, and as long as Jews walk the face of the earth, we don't, to understand the Shalacha, you have to be bright, you have to have background, you have to have a good mind. That's not too simple. To understand what the Rav said that night, you only have to be born Jewish or converted to Judaism with a heart and a soul that seeks purity and sanctity. And the Rav developed the idea, Kedako B'Kodesh. He contrasted two terms, Yeyud and Goral. Yeyud and Goral will translate into English. Yeyud, of course, means destiny. Goral means fate. And what's the difference between the two? All of us would like to shape our destiny. All of us would like to shape our destiny. You hear an echo here of Yosef Yechov, of the Chameis Drasher, of what we spoke about, and when it comes to Ashkafa, we'd like to shape our destiny. But we're caught up with fate. Sometimes God wills differently. And the greatest challenge to the Jew is that ultimately, fate and destiny should blend into one in the Messianic period. And to put it on a tangible level, here were Jews in Europe longing, dreaming to come back to Israel, come back to Eretz Yisrael. That was their destiny. That's what they worked for. If you read the memoir literature during the 1920s into the 30s, in every community, there was Bnei Akiva, there was Shomer HaTzair, the youth groups, very powerful, and young people were planning Aliyah and learning Hebrew and mastering Hebrew and learning how to farm. Some of them did go in Aliyah. They achieved their destiny. And others, fate intervened, Hitler came, and all of you know the stories of people from Israel who went back to visit their families in Eastern Europe. Went back to visit. They were already citizens of Palestine, and they went back to visit, and they were caught in Europe, and they became part of the 6 million as Hitler's forces marched on. So you see, there's destiny, there's fate. Happy is the Jewish individual, happy is the human being who can say, my faith and destiny have blended into one. There are people who grew up in the Bronx, came in Aliyah, came, knocked on doors, unknown, unsought, uncalled, unwanted. And Baruch Hashem, 30 plus years later, they sit in Jerusalem teaching Torah. So there are people who, thank God, to a certain degree, their fate and destiny blended into one, but no one can say it totally. Ad Yemot HaMashiach, here we live in Jerusalem, here we live in a beautiful country, here we have such beautiful youth, such magnificent youth, and here we have such heartache and such difficulty and such stress and such tragedy and so many funerals and so many young people, children who have no childhood, teenagers who don't know what it means to be a teenager. They're already caught up with the responsibilities of Am Yisrael. So Ad Yemot HaMashiach, no one can say that our fate and destiny blend into one totally, but this constantly has to be our goal. Fate and destiny. We have a destiny, we have to strive, we have to do everything we can, and we have to pray that HaShgacha will be kind to us and the divine fate will enable our destiny to be achieved. Now, in order to achieve this destiny, and here was the genius of the Rav, he utilized the most magnificent volume we have in the 24 books, what Rabbi Akiva calls Kodesh HaKadoshim, the book of Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs. And the Rav, being a giant of Torah, and knowing that it's forbidden to translate Shir HaShirim allegorically until you learn the Pshat, dealt with the Pshat of Shir HaShirim. And the Rav said, what does Shir HaShirim teach us? What is the message there? It has a message that was overwhelming for every individual. And at that moment in 56 and all that had happened with the Holocaust and the state of Israel. Now, what is the message of Shir HaShirim? Shir HaShirim is a beautiful love story. There's the Dod and the Doda. And this young couple, they have a romance, they're in love, they enjoy seeing each other, and they're planning their future together. And one night, the Dod, the lover, comes along. He didn't have a date that night. He didn't arrange a date. All of you understand, when you start going out with a girl, you have to have a date one time, two times, three times. But the time you've gone out with the girl 10 times, I hope it's reached the point that you can knock on her door and she's going to be happy to see you. And cold, though deed, though fake, the lover knocked on the girl's door. And that night she was tired. Pashantati et kuntati, echal bishena. I'm quoting from Shir HaShirim. I took off my clothes. I'm wearing my nightgown. Ugh, I'm too tired to get dressed. And she says to her boyfriend, her lover, who she loved. But she says to him, listen, I'm tired tonight. I'm exhausted tonight. I had a hard day. I don't know, whatever it was. School was difficult. Business was difficult. The news was hard. I'm going to go to sleep early. Do me a favor. Pashatati et kuntati, echal bishena, come back tomorrow. V'dodi chamak kalachlo. He went away that night, but he went away and he didn't come back tomorrow. And she realized the terrible mistake she made. Opportunity strikes once. There's such a powerful message in Shir HaShirim. Whether it has to do with education, whether it has to do with finding a Rebbe, whether it has to do with finding a wife, whether it has to do with making the move and getting married, whether it has to do with Aliyah, with career orientation, whatever context you place it into, opportunity knocks. Kol dodi do fake. But the great individual has to know that's your destiny. Grab it. Don't let it get away. Don't let it sneak away. Don't let Shashirim happen. It was a tragic mistake on her part. Dodi chamach halachlo. It didn't come back. And then the next morning she wakes up and she suddenly realizes, what have I done? My beloved is gone. How did I let him get away? Why didn't I get dressed? Why didn't I put on my clothes? Well, why didn't I make the effort? And she's frantic and she starts running and seeking and searching. And somehow she never finds him again. Ad Yemot HaMashiach. They'll never be reunited. And the Rav says, that's the message of Shir HaShirim. When opportunity strikes, when the beloved knocks on the door, cold, though deed, though fake, don't let that beloved one get away. Rise to the occasion. Accept the challenge. Open the door. Grab the opportunity. Don't be like the Doda in Shir HaShirim. Destiny is before your eyes. Be big enough. Be great enough. Be strong enough. Be mature enough to grab, to open the door, to accept the challenge, to rise to the occasion, to overcome your own innate laziness, your own innate, at times, feeling of inadequacy, which is part of the human geschichte. And the Rav said, and now we come to the high point of the Kol Dodi Dofeik. And this will live on as long as Jews walk the face of the earth. No one ever said it better. It's, in my opinion, the high point of the Rav's life. This is the moment, Ein Lecha Adam She'ein Lo Sha'ah. There's one moment that's eternal, that's way beyond 1958. Every child in every religious high school in Israel, in every ulpana, in every yeshiva tichonid, in every yeshiva gavoa, in every yeshiva hezder in the state of Israel, every child, every boy, girl, every man, woman has been raised, has been nurtured on the following words of the Rav. And the Rav said, God knocked on our door. There were six different knocks. Kadosh Baruch Hu was kind to us. After all that happened in Treblinka and Buchenwald, I hold the Hebrew text in front of me. It's very hard for me to look at English. There is an English translation by Larry Kaplan. If you look into the Rav and to my biography on the Rav, I have a long footnote. There was another translation by a Dr. Gordon, which has not been published at all. I understand that Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's son, wishes to publish Gordon's translation. He considers it better than the Kaplan translation. But as far as I know, the one that has been published is, of course, the Kaplan translation. But it's very hard for me. I heard the talk in Yiddish, and when I hear my Rebbe speak in Yiddish, I read it fluently and with peace of mind in Hebrew. It's very difficult for me to read a Hebrew, an English translation. By the way, I was responsible personally for raising the funds, and this has been translated into Russian, and it's gone through a number of editions, sponsored by Shvut Ami, of the Kol Dodi Dofeik in Russian. I understand there's also a French translation as well. And the Rev says, 8 years ago, when we still could hear the cries of the Jews being burned alive in Majdanek and Treblinka and Buchenwald, when we still could smell the gas chambers, when the night was filled with total chesed upon him, we could not understand God, when the dark angel, the backside of God, the Sitra Masvisra, as it's called in the Kabbalistic literature, at that moment when all looked lost for the Jewish people, suddenly destiny knocked on our door. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knocked on our door. Our beloved God knocked on the door of the Jewish people. You'll ask me, how many times did HaKadosh Baruch Hu knock? Did our beloved one knock? Did our dod knock? The Rav says, it appears to me that at the very least, there were six knocks on Hador. And the Rav listed out the Shesh Tfikot, the tremendous miracles that happened with the establishment of the State of Israel. And of course, miracle number one, for the first time in the political history of the world, for the first time where East and West were constantly at loggerheads, America and Russia agreed to establish the State of Israel. The Rav said, when you look at the history of the UN, there is not one major issue on which Russia and America agreed. Time after time, they vetoed resolutions. And here, a miracle happened in the political sphere. Suddenly, the State of Israel is declared, and among the initial major countries to recognize the nation state are both the great America and the large, powerful Russia. And the Rav says, if you ask me, I believe that the whole reason that the divine providence allowed for the creation of the United Nations was for this moment to come about, that the United Nations should serve as a vehicle for the establishment of the State of Israel. And this was the first miracle, the first knock. Kol dodi do fake. Look, open your eyes. God has returned to the human arena. The nightmare, the darkness of the Holocaust is ended. Open your eyes. Look at this political miracle. And you have to understand that not in the context of today. Today, America and Russia, Russia is now no longer Russia. Russia now is the magnificent communist empire, the 15 Soviet socialist republics, the Soviet Union. Today, Russia is one country out of many. But today, Russia and America are on good terms, good relations. Look at NATO. Look what's happening. NATO is no longer a military organization. It's a political organization today. But we're talking 1948. The Cold War, East versus West, the Soviet dream, workers of the world unite, all national borders will fall, the entire world will be united under the communist banner. Power belongs to the workers, to the masses. Compare that to the capitalist dream of the United States society, the capitalist dream of the individual rights of the pursuit of happiness. Compare that to the Russian concept of the corporate state. And with it all, Russia and America unite, Israel. That was the first knock. The second knock, of course, was the military victory. Here you had a little army without arms. Think of the State of Israel. Think of the embargo. Think of the United States itself that had an embargo. Anyone from my generation can tell you stories. I used to walk to elementary yeshiva. I went to Yeshiva Salanta. I lived on Washington Avenue on 180th. Salanta was on Webster Avenue on 178th. We were about four or five blocks from the yeshiva, if you know the map of the Bronx. We walked along Park Avenue. In Park Avenue, a block and a half down from 180th, between 179th and 178th, was a large paper factory. And one day we're walking to yeshiva, and police cars and unmarked cars are parked outside the factory. We didn't understand what's going on. And the next morning we read headlines in the Daily News and in the New York Post. They arrested the owners of the factory, that little factory, stationery, printing of stationery, paper goods, was also a front for shipping weapons to the State of Israel. They would collect weapons, put them into the boxes, cover it up with envelopes and with notebooks, and all of them have stories like this. And the next day, they were under arrest. This was America, the embargo. How did you get arms? Czechoslovakia gave us a little bit here, a little bit there, smuggled in. And against all the powerful Arab armies who were armed to the teeth, and we had a great miracle of Rabin, Biyad Ma'atim, so many in the hands of so few. And not only that, the very fact that they declared war. The Rav says, had they accepted partition, how big would Israel have been? The whole Negev would have been out of our hands. Yerushalayim would have been out of our hands. At least we had West Jerusalem at the time after the Milchemet HaShichur, the War of Liberation. A good part of the Galilee would have been out of our hands. Had the Rav said, had Paro allowed the Jews to go like they first requested to worship God, the Jews would have had a return. Moshe Rabbeinu would have given his word. After 3 days, they would have to come back. But because Paro was obstinate, we were privileged to have Yetziat Mitzrayim. And here you had the great miracle, of the great Arab armies, so many Arab armies, and little Israel, with a minimum of weapons, won the war, and the Arabs made the mistake of fighting, and the state gained practically twice as much land as was originally proposed and offered to them under the partition plan of the United Nations. So here too, you had a second miracle. Of course, then the Rav spoke about the third miracle, which may be the greatest miracle of all. Those of you who have studied Catholic theology, those of you who have studied the Church Fathers, those of you who are aware of the Christian spiritual thrust, what is their point of view? We all descend from the Jews. Jesus was a Jew, but the Jews made a big mistake in that they rejected Jesus. And that's why the Jews went into exile, and that's why the Jews lost their homeland, and that's why the Jews lost the state of Israel. And the Jews will not come back until they accept Jesus. And following World War II, so many Jews assimilated, so many Jews intermarried, so many Jews walked away from their religion, from their faith, and took the easy way out. And we have, in modern times, you have no better example than your former Secretary of State of the United States, Madeleine Albright, who either was the stupidest woman alive because she claimed she didn't know her grandparents were Jewish, or she just figured it was good for her advancement on the American scene to deny the fact that she was of Jewish origins. But take a look what happened. The state of Israel is declared. The Jew has returned home. The Jew has come to Palestine. The Jew has come to Yerushalayim. And all of Catholic theology, if I can quote Rebbe Nitbadu Bepahesia, Al Yedei Yesod Medinat Yisrael, Keta'anot Sheka. And all of Catholic theology is debunked, is refuted, is negated, is abrogated. But Bahesia, in front of the entire universe, in front of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of people, well, nigh at that time already billions of people, as being incorrect. And the Rav said something I'll never forget. The audience laughed. At the time, I was too young to appreciate the depth of what he said on this topic, but how these words ring in my mind until today. And the Rav said, we just can understand what America is about, what Christian civilization is about, what Christian theology is about. The Rav quoted the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Kufrei Amid Bet, 105b. And the Gemara talks about Bilam HaRasha, Mei Birchato Shaloto Rasha, Ata Lamad Mahaya Belibo. That from the way Bilam wanted, finally, the way he blessed the Jews, you can see that although he was blessing them, he really wanted to curse them and maledict them. And from interpreting the words of his blessing, you can see what was originally on his mind. You'll see the exposition in the Gemara. It's also brought down by Rashi. And the Rav applied that. Recently, the Rav said there was a press conference. The Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, was asked by one of the reporters at the press conference John Foster Dulles appeared at some Senate committee, and one of the senators asked him, Secretary of State, can you tell us why the Arabs hate the Jews. And the Secretary of State, an intelligent man, United States Secretary of State, answered in front of everyone, the Arabs hate the Jews because they killed their God, meaning the Jews killed Mohammed. And of course, everyone knew the Secretary of State made a bad mistake, a bad error. The Jews never killed Mohammed, but Rebbe said so insightfully that this was exactly like Bilam. From the answer, you see what was on his mind. What was on his mind when they asked John Foster Dulles, why do the Arabs hate the Jews? In his mind, he was interpreting it. They're asking me why I hate the Jews, why Christians hate the Jews, why Catholics hate the Jews, why Protestants have enmity for the Jews. Why does the non-Jewish world have such enmity for the small, brilliant, intelligent, upright, decent, ethical, moral people? And he answered, because they killed my God. He was referring to Jesus, but his tongue slipped, and he put it in the context of Mohammed. And the Rav says, "Bemkom lagot et hamilim mishichenu, ani kishlatzmi, paltu shvatav davarim achirim v'yamar ravavim muhmad Mohammed." And wow, what the Rav says, it was subconscious. He meant to say, why do I hate the Jews? Because they killed my God. Of course, he was answering the question, and he stated it in the framework of Mohammed. And you see Catholic, Christian, non-Jewish theology here, non-Jewish philosophy. You see the problem, the interrelationship of the Mother Church, of the Universal Church, and the Protestant Church with the Jew, and why Israel is such a difficult topic for them, because it refutes their theology. And this was the third great knock, the third great miracle, that Baruch Hashem, we don't have to feel second best. We don't have to feel thwarted. We don't have to feel defeated. We can stand proudly and say, we did not accept Jesus, and we have returned home. And the Rav says here, I remember hearing it in my own ears, he says, I have tremendous nachat when I read in the Sunday newspaper that the Jewish state has not yet reacted. There's no official statement because it was Saturday in Jerusalem and the press office was closed. Could you imagine the Jewish state observes Shabbat, the seventh day of the week, not Sunday, and the world has to make its peace with it. Kol do di do fake. This is a great miracle. And of course, the Rav went further, the fourth knock, and perhaps to us the most important knock of all, because many of us sitting in this room are only here because of this fourth knock. And the Rav said, there's another great miracle of the state of Israel. As a result of the state of Israel, our youth is returning home. Our youth is coming back. Following the Holocaust, following the Hestapanim, Hanoah, HaMitboleh, VaHanavuch, we had youth that was assimilating, youth that was confused. Hamonei HaAm HaYudi, VaNoah HaYudi, Bifrat, HaHitbolelut Cholcha VeGavra, and the assimilation just continued building up. There were many reasons why, but after the Holocaust, we were left with a feeling of Yayush. Who could overcome this feeling? So many dead. We raised our hands. We were left with a feeling of fear if the world could kill so many Jews in a civilized world, a civilized country, Germany, Berlin. What hope is there for our future? We were left with a world of Amratzot. Who knew how to learn? The Rabbanim were killed. The Rosh Yeshiva were killed. The great Hasidic leaders were killed. Millions upon millions of devout, pious Jews were killed. You take a look at the United States, the Jews were assimilated, some 50%, some a third, some a quarter, but assimilation was at every corner. Intermarriage lurched in every home. And suddenly, there is a Jewish state. And once there is a Jewish state, the Rebbe says, we listen to the radio, we open the newspaper, and wherever we go, we see the state of Israel is mentioned, and everyone who has Jewish blood within him suddenly is troubled, suddenly is disquieted, suddenly has to think, suddenly has to ask, who am I? Where do I come from? I'm also a Jew. What is this Jewish state? What is happening? And the Rebbe said, once we start to ask these questions, then I yid find them fragen, kishudi matchil lachshov litmobain, when a Jew starts to ask, to think, when he doesn't sleep at night, kishashena tono dead, that he can't sleep at night, like the king Ahasuerus of old. Once we start asking these questions, we have no idea where it's going to lead to. Once he starts asking questions, once he starts seeking, once he starts searching, we have no idea how far it can lead. And we see already it's led so many thousands of young people to come back to their heritage, to come back to their people, to come back to their Torah, to embrace the Jewish way of life, belev v'nefesh, with heart and soul, with two outstretched arms, kol dodi dofek. This too was a tremendous miracle. Of course, in retrospect, we bow our heads. What insight. What foresight. This was said in 1956. Who would believe that 40, 50 years later, you have over 2 million Jews in the world, Shomrei Torah and Mitzvot, the number increases daily. Who could believe, take a look at the Lubavitcher movement, the Shlichim, that since the death of the Rebbe, practically 10 years ago, it has doubled and tripled, and in every corner of the earth, you have Lubavitch, you have Mikvot, you have Taret Mishpacha, Shabbat, and Kashrut. Who could believe that the Lithuanian yeshiva could be rebuilt and have more students than they ever had in the most golden period of Europe? You take Panovich Yeshiva alone. It has more students in Panovich today than Mir Voloshin and Slabodka and Telch put together and added up. Slabodka, Telch, what are we talking about? Voloshin in their golden period. You're talking 350 students, 400. Some people say impossible. Never was. You talk about Panovich, 2,000 students. Talk about Lakewood. Talk about Yeshiva University. Look at the statistics. Look at the heads, the yeshiva. Look what's happened in the state of Israel. Look at the innovation. Look at the youth. Look at the Balei Tshuva. Look at the outreach. Look at the dream. And here's the Rebbe in 1956, when, to use the modern Israeli expression, Harayon Hazel Tayaba Chitulim, this concept was only in diapers. Who could dream? Who could see? And hear the Rav, belay the nefesh, b'fnei am v'yedah, kol dodi dofek. Jewish children are starting to ask questions. And once Jewish children ask questions, we have no idea how far it will lead them. And I will conclude, we're not concluding the kol dodi dofek, but next week, the major part of the shiur will be devoted to finishing the kol dodi dofek, and seeing the outflow and the question, the unbelievable letter that the Rav writes after his wife dies, that once again reunites us with the kol dodi dofek, and its unbelievable, powerful, magnificent influence. But you look, the questions, where will it lead us? And this was basic to the Rav's theology. Those of you who know how many times the Rav darshened on Pesach, and time and again throughout the generations, throughout, I want to say, the millennium, the 100 years, basically, where the Rav functioned, time and again, the Rav came back to one simple question. It was overwhelming in its simplicity. But all of us know from kindergarten on, what's the greatest moment? I have grandchildren. How do you know a grandchild has arrived? When he gets about the Seder, and that little 4, 5, 6-year-old, Manish Tana Halayla Hazeh. And Patich Valachregan, the fear Kasha Zaban, Yeshalat Abaha Kushiyot, and the kid, father, I'm going to ask the four questions. And the kid gets up and asks the four questions, and you can't begin the Haggadah, you can't begin the Magid, you can't begin the Avodim Hayinu Lafaro until the questions are asked. And the Rav time and again would ask, why? Why did Chazal, why were they so makpid? Why were the Metakne Nusach Haggadah so insistent that the whole Haggadah begins with questions? Bizman HaMishnah, you know, it's in the Mishnah already. They'll write the questions were slightly different after the Mishnah, after the Churban Abayit, so the question shifted slightly, but the emphasis on questions. And the Rav said, because we educate a child from childhood to be a good Jew, you have to ask questions. You have to seek. You have to search. When you have that attitude, there's no end to how great you'll be in commitment and Torah and learning and knowledge and Yirat Shemayim and purity. Because a person that questions, a person that seeks, he ultimately achieves. And this is why we begin the Haggadah with the questions. And if I can paraphrase Rebbe here, the greatest miracle of the state of Israel, there isn't a Jew in the world that has to ask, in the words of Yonah, who am I? Where do I come from? Where am I going? What has been my past? What has been my future? What has been my fate? And what do I want to be my destiny? So I reiterate. There's no question that Rebbe became a Mizrahiite following World War II. That the process had to be gradual goes without saying. A great Talmud Chacham, a Golan Adir, doesn't suddenly walk away from Chaim Moshe Grzinski's outlook and Rebbe Eliezer Silva's outlook, although Rebbe Eliezer Silva is not the classic Agudist. His outlook basically was somewhere between Aguda and Mizrahi. It was meshed together. But you don't walk away from your parents, your grandparents, your heritage, your family, your yeshiva, your beis medrash, your shtibble, be it the Gerish Shtibble or the Majlis Shtibble in Warsaw, or be it the Aguda with a PhD in Berlin and Frankfurt. It had to be a gradual process. But there's no question that in the Chamesh Drashot, and today when we develop the idea, which I have to say about Liechtenstein begins, but I have added to it, if you compare, you'll understand, he deals with it just on a general basis, and I've added to it very concrete, tangible proofs. Rebbe is an activist. And in Rebbe's mind, what characterizes his Mizrahi is activism vis-a-vis Agudat Yisrael. Rivka versus Yitzchak. His definition of that machloket is classic. But then comes the great moment. He's the Mizrahiite. He is hitting al chait for what we sinned against the Jews. We were not activists before World War II. During World War II, not activists enough. Remember what I told you about Russian Jewry, which I'm an eyewitness to, happened after Shia. Rebbe's an activist, fine. But there comes a moment, and it may be the ultimate moment in Rebbe's life. He gives this drasha, Kadako Bakodesh, with sources, with material, with innovative thinking, with his seminal mind. It was the 8th anniversary of the State of Israel, 1956. Puts it into the context of Shir HaShirim, puts it into the context of Yehud and Gerol, destiny and fate. Turning our fate into our destiny. We're the masters of our destiny, but fate may or may not intervene the way we like it. Ultimately, Bimot HaMashiach, they will blend into one. But a person has to know never to let opportunity be missed. Kol dodi do fake. The beloved one knocks, the woman is tired, she can't take a pashatati, how can I get dressed again and put on my makeup again and comb my hair again and put my contact lenses in and be prepared to see my boyfriend, come back tomorrow. And some reason, chamak halachlo, he was busy, he disappeared, he got involved, other opportunities, and she spends the rest of her life searching for him and they'll only be reunited by Yimot HaMashiach. We have to learn not to make that mistake. Kol do di do fake, 1948, on the ashes of Treblinka and Auschwitz, etc. And the Rav says there were six tremendous knocks. We dealt with the first ones. Number one, the political miracle. Russia and America agree. Number two, the military victory on the battlefield. Ma'atim succeed in conquering the masses, the multitudes of the Arab, well-equipped armies. Number three, the theological miracle that non-Jewish Christian theology is debunked. We do not accept Jesus, and yet we return to our own homeland. And number four, perhaps the most important miracle of all, that assimilation is now met head-on, is now challenged. Jewish youth begins to question. And once youth begins to question, we never know how it will end. Once you ask, who am I, what am I, the words of Jonah, what am I running away from, what is my destiny, where am I going, once you ask those questions, the road to coming back to your people becomes a lot shorter, a lot happier, a lot more meaningful. And the Rebbe said this in 58, in 56, when this was just beginning, it was in its nascent stage, its infantile stage, and look where we are today, so many decades later. My dear friends, thank you for your participation. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya.